in between. It's paranormal and guaranteed to make you go, My guest list is always up at www.gscott.com, and do tune in to the Dawn of Shades from 7 to 9 p.m. on Tuesdays.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Light up your night with The Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
A Global Focus with guest Daryl the Alien Hunter. Daryl Sims has authored with Patricia Gray two books. The first, Alien Hunter, The Evidence and Light, and the second, Alien Hunter, Evidence and Truth About Alien Implants. To a Global Focus with tonight's guest, Daryl Sims. This is Trish Sheridan speaking. Thank you for joining us. A Global Focus airs live on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network with anchor station UPRN 105.7 FM New Orleans and numerous venues, all accessible at ufoparanormalradio.com. Thanks to Joe Montaldo, UPRN network owner and ICAR international director, for making these programs possible. Daryl Sims, our guest tonight. Very impressive. RHA and certified master hypnotherapist, the Alien Hunter, has been at the forefront of alien investigation for more than 35 years. From ages 4 to 17, he experienced numerous conscious contacts with the malignant alien presence. Determined to transform his life role from the hunted to the hunter, he prepared himself mentally, physically, and spiritually to become a warrior for the cause of the alien abductee. At the heart of Sims' work is a proactive search for physical evidence and its forensic analysis. A private investigator and former MP, Sims treats abduction cases like crime scenes. By the early 1980s, he'd begun assembling his groundbreaking collection of alleged alien implants. In 1995, he organized the first public extractions and subsequent analysis of more alleged alien artifacts. Other landmark cases include the 1992 double mass abduction and his discovery of subdermal alien fluorescence. Trace evidence such as this are currently undergoing DNA testing. Sims' scientific and academic dream team of consultants includes two cardiovascular surgeons, a brain surgeon, four MDs, and a criminal forensic scientist from a major university, and an Ultratech specialist currently conducting a two-year study on Sims' implant samples. This work is a culmination of 24 surgeries to date, from the 1980s to the latest one in Flint, Michigan last month. Sims' hundreds of case files give him a unique view of the relationship between alien and prey, and he is a sought-after consultant to mental health professionals worldwide. Sims' numerous hypnotherapy certifications include one in hypnotic anesthesiology. Sims is a popular media guest and draws a crowd all over the author two books with Patricia Gray, Alien Hunter, The Evidence and Light, and Alien Hunter, Evidence and Truth About Alien Implants. Tonight, Daryl will offer insight into his multimodality approach to unraveling the mystery of alien abduction. Daryl is a licensed private investigator in the state of Texas, part cop, part medical investigator, part intelligence operative, and part profiler. The Alien Hunter shares his unique theories that drive his investigations and challenge the boundaries of what we think of as UFO and alien. Daryl, welcome to the program. Our audience is very excited to be a guest this evening. I know you have a great deal of information to share with us this evening. And lastly, I hear you're going to L.A. this weekend. Is that true?
That is correct. I will be going to L.A. I'll leave Sunday morning very early, and then I'll come back on Tuesday sometime. I got contacted recently about a program William Shatner hosts, and I'm going to be interviewed on that program as a finale, they're going to do one on alien implants, and they wanted me to be the expert for that since I discovered this phenomena in 1960. So anyway, I'll be working with that, and we were kicking around the idea, seeing if we could get Fran Drescher, the actress, who apparently just admitted that her and her husband both had been abducted by aliens years ago when they were young people, and hopefully get her there to call, possibly do an interview with her.
That would be wonderful. Of course, many people remember Fran Drescher's excellent media work as the star of the Nanny program. She's a wonderful actress, and you know, these Huffington Post and other articles to me really suggest someone who is very serious in the field, a very sincere person, very articulate. Boy, she'd make one heck of a spokesperson. I hope that is possible. Now, Daryl, many new developments in your research, and first of all, you do use a multimodality approach to the multi-aspectual abduction phenomenon. First, please tell your audience briefly, for our audience listeners who are not aware, your personal motivation to embark on this field of study, and also that research has been joined by professionals from many disciplines across the world.
Well, my interest in the UFO phenomena wasn't it came at a very early age. You might say I was a captive audience. I was an abductee at age 4, and that was in 1952, so that kind of tells a little bit about me. But basically, I simply had this propensity, and we've known this ever since all my time growing up, of being able to wake up at the wrong time, so to speak, not just in sleep, but even in surgery one time, I set up on a general anesthesia, and it scared everybody half to death. The point is that when I sense something is incorrect or wrong, even when I'm on an anesthetic or in an alien's control, I wake up. And I did in that event at age 4, and I couldn't figure out what this guy, whatever this thing was, it was pure white with large black eyes, was doing in my little room in Midland, Texas. And the sum of that whole story to me is that as I was thinking, what in the world is he doing with no clothes on in the middle of winter because it was cold? And he turned around and looked at me. He could hear me thinking. And, of course, I was stunned at looking at the large black eyes that were perfectly round instead of the almond-shaped Hollywood eyes, alien eyes that you see anymore. And I noticed that he didn't have any genitalia, and he didn't have a belly button. And obviously, if people or anyone doesn't have a belly button, you weren't born. You're either hatched, cloned, or you got here some other way. You're manufactured, even. And, of course, if you didn't have genitalia, you don't breathe. So the question is, the big question is to me now, being a lot older and having a lot more information, if you don't have genitalia and all this other stuff, what's the interest in the DNA? I mean, that doesn't make any sense.
Very well said. And you know, Daryl, I was very struck by the comment in one of your books the second book that noted this, that during the last encounter with the alien at age 17, the alien tried to take your life. That must have been quite a horrific event.
I was not prepared for any of that. I was just a 17-year-old kid going through some... through about 10 events from 1952 till 1965, and for that period of time, for about 13 years there, I just had no idea what was going on and who they were or why they were doing what they were doing. I tried to put it out of my mind as much as possible, and the last event was quite horrific, and if I had any views that they were here to save the planet, fix the ozone hole, or anything like that, that all ended for me.
Thank you very much for that. Those further clarifications. Now, you know, Daryl, you've also noted that a particular alien has been following your family for several generations, and you know, that type of pattern has also been discovered in ICAR research. Daryl, how can someone break intergenerational alien monitoring? Is it possible?
Well, it it was possible in my case to break it for my particular life, but I'm not sure that quote unquote affected the rest of our family. I think it has somewhat, but let me give you an example. My son was abducted when he was 6. That's what really drug me into the events again. Even though my events stopped at age 17, when I had a son at age 6, they got him, and that changed my whole view. I mean, as far as I was concerned, you could abduct me, do whatever, and I could live with it, get along with it. But when you come after my children, as far as I'm concerned, it's kidnapping, and you're on the wrong side. And at that point, I became it turned me into an alien hunter, so it did. So, my son, after a great deal of everything in the world, prayer and anything you can imagine that was spiritual and that was physical that we could do, we did. And eventually, they left my son alone and his wife, who was an abductee. And fortunately, their grandchild, my grandchild now, has not had these experiences. However, the other day, my brother came to me and mentioned that his daughter was describing these entities consciously with great detail. And obviously, they've gone after his daughter. And, of course, he's an abductee himself as well.
Thanks for that information. I know it certainly is a multi-aspectual phenomenon. I, too, think that I have a relative who refuses to admit that he is an experiencer, but perhaps I shouldn't really give any other information on that. Of course, I am. Now, Daryl, I appreciate your observation of the importance of the experiencers, that several of the experiencers realize the significance of this alien presence. Now, Daryl, you and your SABRE team recommend a proactive approach at dealing with these events. You had that in the 1992 mass abduction. Also, proactive approach, would that be seeking regression and neuro-linguistic programming, perhaps? Your suggestions on that?
Well, basically, we're interested in looking at anyone's case I just refer to it as different hats. And the different hats that we use to look at an individual's case or circumstance involves the differing hats that we use, so to speak. The medical scientific hat is an example. The cop hat from my PI background is an example here. To question individuals and who've had these experiences with that are generally usually only held for people who are in very serious circumstances, where a police officer might investigate a case or a detective. Then we also use what we call an intelligence hat. My past background in the intelligence community gives me some degree of ability in that area, so to speak. Obviously, I wear an abductee hat simply because of the fact that I am one. And the last area of the main hats that we use is a spiritual hat. This is the investigative tool that I've used, but I have, since I am a Christian, I did not want it to prejudice my decisions in all my investigations. I wanted to use it last, so to speak. Because the first bullet going to be fired at me, of course, is going to be, well, since you're a Christian, you have to come to some kind of super spiritual conclusions without any basis of science or medical or anything else. Well, that simply isn't the case because we have literally used every other resource first. And when you put that spiritual hat on with the intelligence hat, the cop hat, the medical hat, the Native American hat, which all that one means is simply the Native American Indian Irish, and we find 45% of all these people are Native American Indian Irish. We discovered that back quite a while ago, back in the 80s. But the point being that these are tools that we use to look at people's events and their circumstances, and using these type tools, they're like eyes, really, and they give us these seven different hats give me 14 different eyes, so to speak, to look at an event. So I'm not prejudiced with only one viewpoint. And this helps us immensely. and it helps abductees and contactees to understand their experiences a great deal more, and gives us a chance to explore and exploit their events so that they can do something about it if they choose to.
That's interesting information, Daryl. You know, first of all, on the hats, that's a great way to define the different focus points that you need for this research. First of all, on the abductee hat, Daryl, I think it's great that as a researcher and as a past abductee, you can appreciate and empathize what is occurring with a current abductee. That's so important. So often in the field, particularly in the past, you'd have researchers questioning whether or not even experiencers or contactees should be joining the dialogue. They're very, very important. And, of course, at ICAR, we know they're very important, as you and your SABR team do as well. Now, on that Native American hat, now, you know, I always loved that idea, Daryl, of yours, that the aliens would be very impressed by warrior traits of bravery. Of course, their traits of bravery under the full spectrum of Earth's races, but that always very much intrigued me, that perhaps the aliens are very interested genetically modifying traits of resistance. Native American, Irish, other types are really known for tremendous feats of bravery. What are your comments on that?
Well, basically, the issue is for me concerning the Native American hat is that I noticed that especially in my case and in Erdley's as well, that the native the alien doesn't like resistance. They want obedience. They want blind obedience and fear, and they usually get what they want. And when they find that they can't control you, that you in effect are not going along with the program, things usually intensify for you and gets worse. And, of course, one could say, well, I need to quit resisting, I need to quit doing things so that things would go better for me. Well, again, that's a mentality that one can choose if they want to, but it's not one that I choose. Again, when I came after my son, that was the end of the road for me. Now I hunt them that hunted me, and the warrior no longer is, he's not sitting around a campfire anymore. He's looking for the ones that created the problem, and that's exactly what I intend to do.
And boy, that's a very appropriate focus to take. Now, Daryl, I have a great question coming to the room, but I just wanted to mention on your other hats, for example, the medical scientific hat. I remember decades ago that you had a wonderful conference with physicians in Houston on the importance of the forensic evidentiary investigative approach to these. Now, several key members of your SABR team hold medical specialties. You yourself have several treatment specialties. And on that private investigator hat, I had no idea that your efforts contributed to obtaining over 500 arrests and 42 felony convictions against offenders within the last 3 years in the Houston area, and that was due to your excellent private investigator efforts. Good for you.
Well, thank you for that. Some people, the people on the conspiratorial part of this kind of phenomena think that, you know, I must be getting all my money from the government. The fact is I work like anybody else, and I'm a small real estate investor, and that's how I fund a lot of my work. Everything that we do with these abductees and for these abductees is absolutely 100% free. We've never charged them a penny. Out of the 24 surgeries we've done thus far, we've not charged a penny to anyone for any reason. And I've gone through this phenomenon, and I can't imagine people going through this and actually having to pay for it. I understand people who do charge, and I don't have a pursuit due. I don't care about it. But for me personally, I can't do that. It just doesn't make any sense for someone like me to charge people for that. So in the policing world, I simply use my private investigation skills to go after people who have cheated people, particularly in the real estate or other realms, financially, and have just destroyed their families, the Bernie Madoff types. And I have netted 42 felonies against these type people in the last 3 years. So I'm pretty proud of that myself.
That's much to your credit. And before we get to a really excellent question from Chip, the host of Chip Mine Cemetery, I just wanted to make two more points here on your hats. That intelligence hat, you do have intelligence career experience, and you believe that intelligence gathering and analysis of the alien are key to understanding the alien presence and intent?
This can actually be underscored by Jacques Vallée. One day went to a conference, and he met a man he refers to, obviously, he gave him a name called Major Murphy. And I listened to the story, and I was most impressed because I'm ex-intelligence, and I'm sitting there listening to the gospel, as far as I'm concerned. Vallée was complaining, said, well, all these people at this conference, they're just a bunch of goofs. There's no science, there's no this, there's no anything. There's no real procedures and so on. And this major went to have coffee with him, and he says, what makes you think this problem? And Vallée said, I just couldn't believe what I was hearing. He said, this ex-intelligence guy changed his entire view on the phenomenon. He said, you have to study the phenomenon, and when you do, you see that the alien is getting people to betray their own race, literally, in order to side with them and to support them and their viewpoints and so on. He said, this is an intelligence operation. It always has been. That man was so right. I mean, I sat there and was just in the amen corner. I mean, I just laughed because that's an intelligence hat. Let me explain this to the audience real quick. Doesn't care about the cop hat, doesn't care about the medical hat, doesn't care about... It's not really that interested in. It's interested in if a UFO lands, a UFO hat, so to speak, they want to take pictures, they want to look at this, they want to talk about it, and so on, get on, you know, do whatever, you know, and talk about it. The medical and scientific hat, it wants to study it, and so on. The cop hat wants to investigate all the people who said they saw it and see who was really telling the truth or not. The intelligence hat only wants to know one thing. Why are they here? What are they really doing? It's not interested in all that other stuff. It's interested in finding out exactly what they're doing. And that's a huge hat that almost no one delves into, because I guess maybe because of their lack of experience, or they just so busy thinking they're here to save the planet, fix the ozone hole, or something else, that might not even be the case whatsoever. That may be a red herring.
It's intriguing information. And before we get to that great question, just the last one on the spirituality hat, Daryl, I'd love for us to discuss at some point during this program the reports of alien interest in the human soul, and I'm wondering, too, if you've heard any reports of research or concept of a husk. Both ICAR, International Community for Alien Research, and also the researcher Linda Moulton Howe, have referenced this concept of a husk, the idea of transfer of consciousness from the human to a holding vessel of some type, such as a husk. Anything about husks, and how about their interest in the human soul?
Well, we hear these stories from time to time. Of course, the question to me is not so much what abductees say. I mean, don't get me wrong here. I think what they say is important, you know. But what I'm saying is that a great deal of manipulation occurs from the alien to the individual, and this can fragment into several different ways. It can cause screen memories. It can cause screen dreams, and other phenomena that may only give you partial evidence, and some being correct and other not. I don't know that there's any containment that where people's systems are actually held. I'm not saying it's not possible. I'm not saying it isn't true. I'm just saying I haven't seen any evidence of that yet. Certainly we do hear the stories, but the thing that is to me that is more... from a practical point of view, is how some people can sometimes describe themselves being lying on a table, and they can't see the legs of the alien there because they, and the reason is a true answer, because their eyesight simply can't see beyond the edge of the table. But yet then later they'll describe themselves in great detail looking at themselves, and yet they know that they're not deceased, they're not dead, they're not really out of their own consciousness. And they're sitting there thinking, they're laying there on this table thinking, and they can't figure out how did this occur. And one of the ways it can occur is the fact that the alien is accessing you, and while he's doing that, when you access him, whether you intend to or not, you can actually, this is so strange, see out of his eyes what he's looking at, and it happens to be yourself. So consciousness can be exploited in that sense of the word. And I'm not sure that the concept of the husk is a verifiable one at this point. It certainly is an interesting thing to study, but is fractionated, no question. The consciousness can be dealt with in different ways, but as to an actual containment, I don't know that that's actually occurring itself. But they are very interested in the human soul and the human spirit, and have said so.
Very intriguing information, and right now I'd like to get to the question of Chip, the great host of the Chip Mind Cemetery program. It's a wonderful one, not to be missed. Excellent guest, and Chip is a wonderful interviewer. He and his wife do a great job there with the program. Now, this is a question from Chip. It might be a little bit unusual, but do you remember, Daryl, when you had your last abduction? Am I correct? It was when you were 17? And also, any of the factors there? And the second portion of the question, I'm wondering if it relates to the fact that sometimes when experiencers are researching together or discussing their events, they seem to experience more frequent contact. But first of all, your last abduction, any details, further details you'd like to share? And secondly, can study and research of this phenomenon, particularly with other experiencers, promote more events?
Wonderful questions, both of them. I will answer the first one. I'll tell you what I can about my last event. I know quite a bit about it. And the reason I know so much about it isn't just that I remember so much about it. It's that two other people who were not even born during that time were shown my last event by an alien who abducted me. There were five entities that showed up in that room, in my room at my home, and those five entities do not show up in UFO literature whatsoever. So you can't say, oh, it was the grays, because that just isn't true, that they weren't there. My point is that this was this last event was supposed to be my last event, and apparently I had failed as a as a lab rat. The lab rat didn't do what it was supposed to. In other words, when you pick the lab rat up and pet it, and then give it a little injection and say, you won't remember. This one did, and probably bit the guy several times. So bad lab rat. So that didn't work out for me too well. I'm happy to say. But the reason I've never told much about my events is because the last event was so horrific and involved other entities involved in the alien phenomena that do not show up in UFO literature that I did not want to give away that information. I wanted to use the tool and see if other people out there had similar experiences. And I have found eight people so far who have, and they have described these entities so well and so interestingly that those who have had contact with them ended up with horrific events, grand mal epilepsy, lives completely destroyed. In my opinion, it drove some of them to suicidal difficulties. And in my last event, the only way I described my event, which I did to some people, a bunch of millionaires who wanted to hear all about this privately in Tampa, Florida, years ago. And I told them I wouldn't tell them about the event other than a metaphor, and they agreed. And I said, the metaphor is simply this. Imagine, if you will, a beautiful green field and cattle out on the field out there. And one of them is called Cow 213. And all of a sudden, here comes this little, as the cows are eating, doing their thing, doing what cows do, here comes this little guy with a milk bucket, with large black eyes, a little tiny guy. And he's walking toward a cow. It's Cow 213 and his buddies sit there watching. Cow 213 says, hey, what's that? Who is that? And he said, that's the milkman. What does he do? He said, he milks cows. Oh, okay. Oh, weird. And the cows watch this from time to time, him going to different cows. And obviously the milk I'm talking about here, really not, it's not milk whatsoever. It's sperm. And finally, the cow walks toward the being the milkman walks toward Cow 213 and says, and Cow 213 says, hey, wait a minute. What do you think you're doing? He says, I'm the milkman. I have to milk you. You know, you're a cow, so you have to be milked. Cow 213 says, no, that's not going to happen. He kicks him down the hill. And the little guy goes back to the milk factory. You have to think about what some of these metaphors really mean. And he tells them, you know, the Cow 213 won't let me milk him. And they tell him, oh, well, tell him he's special. Tell him he's unique. Tell him he's wonderful. That always works. He comes back, tries it, gets kicked down the hill again. He goes back with his little bent bucket and everything. He says, Cow 213 kicked me down the hill again. They said, well, go scare him then. Tell him horrible things and scare him. That'll make him comply. It always works. And this goes on for 13 years. This little guy gets beat up, and kicked down the hill by Cow 213. And, of course, all the people in this big convention, this meeting place, all these millionaires looked at me and said, so what happened? I said, well, after 13 years of that, I said, they sent the butcher. I said, that's all I really want to say about my last event. Second half of the question. Do you get in trouble doing investigations? Generally speaking, no. If you tamper with certain types of information, if the alien does not want you tampering with, or if you're onto something and even if you don't have a clue what it is, and most of the time you won't, and they get intrigued or irritated by that, yes, you can bring some smoke down on yourself. We have cases documented, and it wasn't just me. I'm not saying this has all happened to Daryl. It happened to other people who are working with us as well, especially during the 90s, especially during that time, where abductees would be told in advance never to have anything to do with me or with some of our crew. Some of them are some of the nicest, sweetest people in the world. I could understand the aliens saying that about me because I'm a rabble-rouser as far as they're concerned. But some of the people working with me were absolutely the finest, nicest, neatest little people you ever wanted to meet. And they didn't want them to have anything to do with it either because they're involved in the same type of research. So some of the abductees, I'll give you a case in point. One of the people working with me is this lady. And, interestingly enough, her name was Patrice.
but from Texas. she's a lovely lady, though, but from Texas.
Yeah. Was it the one I'm talking to? she came to me one day and said, Ducky, and I said, I never thought you were. And she says, I'm not an abductee. And I said, okay, what is the problem? And she said, I want you to hypnotize me. I said, to what end? She said, I want you to find out what happened to me last night. And I said, what are you talking about? She said, I broke my foot. And I said, you broke your foot while you were asleep? She said, well, in theory, that's what happened. And she said, how would you get a major break in your foot? And so anyway, long story short, is I worked with her and finally got past the screen and all the other things that they do, and they were coming after one of her children. And she fought against them. Physically, she got up and withstood them, and what their controls weren't working on her. And as a result, she was actually taking martial arts during this time, her and her husband, under me and my wife at the time. And she threw what is called a roundhouse kick. It's a circular kick toward the little entity. He saw what was coming and jumped out of the way, and she hit the edge of her desk with the top of her foot and broke a bone deep inside her foot. And that's how her foot got broken. So it was surmised by her that they were tampering with their children as a result of some of the things that we were doing. There were many other cases I could tell. That's just one off the wall. She was not an abductee. She was not an abductee. And they went out of the way to create misery for her.
Very intriguing information. I also have a second question from Chip, the host of Mind Cemetery. He's wondering, would other people who are abductees describe the different ETs who visited them as being perceived by the ETs as failed lab rats, for lack of a better term, that these individuals perhaps would not accept the proposed alien argument as to the alien intent and reason for the different procedures or their interaction even with humans.
Some of the entities, they are running programs. The long and short of that, all of that, is they are running programs given to them by somebody bigger and higher and other than them. The alien, as we understand it, regardless of what you're looking at, whether it's the mantis, whether it's the grays, whether it's the larger gray, the doctor type, whether it's the reptile, it doesn't make any difference which one is tampering with you or if you end up seeing several of them. The fact is they're running programs that are designed for humans by someone else, and in my opinion, and we'll get to this later, the alien himself is not even an alien. And I'll explain that later. I want to tweak your audience here a little bit and see if I can really get some get some dander up here for a second. The alien's opinion may not even be an alien.
Yes, well, we have some excellent questions along that line from our room visitor and ICAR researcher, great researcher, goddess of fire. And I think, too, that will really dovetail into that research, including that transgenic concept. But real quick question here before I forget it, because I really was impressed by the material you have on a recent abduction case involving an Arizona psychologist. You note this individual fought back during the abduction. And, Darryl, what key evidentiary markers were obtained? Any DNA evidence?
Good question. The fact is that we've kept this one under wraps quite a bit because of some of the things that we're doing with the case. But the bottom line is that the individual resist it, this is fascinating to me because he used the same exact thing that I used one night when they were coming into our home at different times, attempting to abduct my daughter-in-law, and I had a razor sharp Japanese sword waiting for him in the room, and he I don't know if he heard the story from me or what. What he had a Japanese sword, he put it next to his bed. He said, I remember that you said they make mistakes. And he said, in case they ever made one, I wanted to be ready. Well, the fact is, he was ready, and they did make a mistake. And as a result, he woke up, and there was one of them standing next to him. And without him thinking or without going through the rigmarole of, wow, I wonder what this is, and isn't this amazing, he simply grabbed the sword and takes a swift strike at it very quickly and literally halves it, and some of the DNA is laying on the floor. His two dogs, there are giant Rottweilers in the other room. There's an entity in the larger room right next to their who is at, and the Rottweilers get into it with another entity that's in the room. They attack it and kill that entity as well, in our view. And the next morning he wakes up in bed, and because what happens is when an entity show up in an event like this, they're not alone. Someone's watching the event all the time. Someone's overseeing that from up above, so to speak. And so somebody cleaned up the matter, so to speak, got the bodies out there. The two dogs died within 60 days. They died from protein starvation. They literally could not assimilate any protein whatsoever after biting these entities. And they literally starved to death. These two massive Rottweilers were starved to death, basically. Got to do nothing for them. The second thing is that there was some DNA left there in the home. I got some of the DNA from a scientist, and I also got some DNA by going there myself with Ron Revere, a friend of mine who's co-working the case with me still. And the preliminary finds are extremely intriguing, and it's got the attention of Bigelow and others interested in this phenomena because of some of the things that were initially found. one scientist stated, and this is just one, there are several scientists that have looked at it. One said, the sample that you sent me is the only tangible biological evidence that exists that links the cattle mutilation samples that I have personally studied with aliens, the grays specifically, the proteins, the enzymes, even some plant material, perfectly matched samples sent to me from cattle mutilations for over the past 35 years. I am very, very excited. You have the only terrestrial life that is not only present on Earth, but your description of the events shows the violent exchange between you and your Wilder's head with them, etc., etc. He said this is the most impressive evidence ever collected, proof of the alien interference on this planet. He says, like winning the lottery with these samples. And the fascinating thing is that you look at the evidence from some of the micrographs of this stuff alone is rather incredible. It actually shows biological animal cells with, so to speak, with plants growing out of the plant stems and other strange phenomena. So we're exploiting that. We're still working with it. We've had three biological people working with us on this. One at a major university, and another one is a forensic scientist. And I don't mind telling you, and it's really weird. Both of them quit before they even really got started. They did not. I'm not sure. They gave no excuse. No, they were very excited, and then they quit before they even got started. I don't know if somebody got to them. I don't know if somebody leaned on them. But one of them won't even return phone calls, will not talk, will not do anything. I'm not sure what. So we're working with that at this point.
Well, I know that you were developing. Here, let me just, someone's calling in. I will speak with that person later. Pardon me. I do realize that you have been developing for a while alien DNA protocols when that type of important evidentiary material is found or will be found. And here we're getting quite a few comments here from the researchers. They want to see reports and so forth. My guess is, am I correct in this, Daryl, that as these reports are drawn up on the findings, those individuals who will find the wherewithal to continue, that they will be subjected to peer review and they will be produced in a report?
Well, that is true. It's really, in my view, and I've taken a lot of heat for this from all kinds of people, good people, that you need to produce everything all at once right now for everybody. Well, that's kind of dumb. You don't do that in any kind of real case. You take the,
exactly.
You keep exporting and doing the best you can, get all the evidence you can, then get it peer-reviewed by people who are not UFO people, because that's the first bullet that's going to be fired at the case. Yes, well, you used UFO scientists. You used UFO everything. No wonder they found in your favor. You don't do that. You use a peer review by people who are not UFO-related, some related people, and that's another reason I don't want to exploit the reports. And second is it's not peer-reviewed yet. And until that happens, until we know what we really have, it's exciting, it's amazing, it's fun, and all that. But you can't just wear a UFO hat and say, oh my gosh, I got to see everything. That's a UFO hat talking. That's not the other six hats. You have to wear them all, in my opinion, to get to do right. And for us to be able to defend ourselves in a forensic setting, we had better be able to produce our case in a forensic setting that can literally hold water. We can't. Something comes up. We just can't do that anymore.
Well said. And, you know, I'm going to make this comment here only because to me it's important to note my approval of you, Daryl, here. And it's coming from the heart. About 2 years ago, you helped me in conjunction with Joe Montaldo and Linda Montaldo. I had a very painful area in the leg, on the leg. There was a very unusual mark working there. It was, took photos. I sent photos to yourself, also to Joe Montaldo and Linda Montaldo. All three of you were very, very helpful. Some of the information that was provided to me from you and the Sabre team was really very, very detailed, and it confirmed some of the developments that I was experiencing then. And also I received great support from Joe and Linda Montaldo. I don't know what I'd do without them. But I just wanted to note that, because if I think highly of you, darn it, it's because you've helped me. Anyway, let's get back to the questions. Now, I do note, and I'm not a member of this group, but I've heard it's excellent, that you provide an online support group at health.groups.yahoo.com, the Alien Hunter Support Group. It's free, as is ICAR. ICAR, too, is a great group. And are you welcome to new members joining?
We're always welcome. The only qualification to joining our online support group, the only thing is that you need to be an abductee or contactee. We don't care if you're one or the other. Nobody gets flamed as a result. Nobody cares about picking on somebody's belief system. They do discuss those belief systems and what's going on with each other. But they're as close as family. Some people refer to themselves as more than family that are there. They love and care for each other. Them who have never met each other before. It's not for everybody, but it's for a lot of people. And we have some wonderful people on it. If you email me at alienhunter.org or go to operationaliendna.com and you click on there and email me, say, I want to know about the support group or I want to know about any of the information we've talked about tonight, I will email you back and send that to you. The support group is free. We don't charge anything for anything that we do. Nothing.
Well, much be commended. Now, very quick question, lest I forget. I noticed that at your Houston UFO network site, some interesting material there. Apparently there was a very recent surgery on an implant retrieval that occurred in Flint, Michigan. Any details on that would be particularly noteworthy to mention tonight?
The fascinating thing about that implant surgery is this. I sent my an investigator who's also an attorney who works on our team, and he is most effective. And the doctor, the morning of the surgery, looks at the object that he's removed, which is about a half inch long, a needle-like object, and he it's actually thicker than a needle. It's not a needle. And he looks at it. It's found behind the patella, the kneecap. And this woman has no idea how this thing got there, and the doctor's just baffled. He looks at it, and he just decides he's going to keep all this for himself, including all the information, including the implant. He's just going to keep it. And the attorney looks at him and smiles and says, we have signed affidavits that this belongs to us. It is legally ours. And you signed off on it as well. You can try to keep that if you want to, but I'll own you tomorrow. And, of course, the guy immediately handed over the stuff. The question is, and we've had this happen a lot, why do these doctors who have no interest in UFOs, nor do they believe in all that stuff, want the evidence? And he literally had to be threatened by my attorney before he would let it go. And he did, of course, quickly after that, but he had no interest in releasing any of that, even to the abductees himself, and everybody signed off, on legal documents. He was going to walk off with that equipment and whatever he had. And so what we're looking for right now is, obviously, we've got evidence stacked up like you can't believe right now. We've got probably 12 cases of fluorescence alone, of good cases of fluorescence that we need DNA testing on. This stuff is not cheap. One really fine scientist and a doctor and a scientist that works with this, he's got two hats, he said the kind of testing that really needs to be done on some of the stuff that you have, he said, Daryl, he said one test is $18,000. He said, that's not the final test, that's the first test. If it turns out to be something like what you're thinking it is, he said, obviously, we need to go forward. He says some of these tests can go upwards as high as $35,000. So it's not like you just go to do some little DNA swab test and that's what it is. It's much more than that. It's difficult to explain that to people. They say, oh, why don't you just go get it tested? Well, why don't you just give me $50,000 and I will? I mean, I have to work and do all kinds. I've kept my family in poverty, in my opinion, for years, paying for things like this to keep this stuff going. And it's important that this be done, but by the same token, I also have to take care of my family, too. So that slowed me down a bit, and I'm having to work extra now, so to speak, to acquire the money. I'm not asking people for money. I'm just simply explaining why we don't have everything done when everybody says, hey, why don't you just get that done? Well, we've got about 20 things done at a cost between $2,000 to $18,000 a piece. Anybody that feels very strongly about that needs to contact me.
Thanks for that info. Very helpful, very intriguing, too, on the latest developments. Now, we have about 3 minutes before the break, and directly after the break, I'd like very much to ask you questions from our great room researcher, investigator. His name is Kopp. That's his nick. He is from the Northeast region. Wonderful mind, great questions. That will be on implants. But for the next 3 minutes, I just wanted to bring this question up to you, Daryl. I'd be very intrigued to hear what you have to say in response. Of course, there is a new syndrome or a new development with experiencers, and rightfully so. It's called post-abduction syndrome. It relates to victims of alien abduction. Now, what modalities can be used to help them deal with such an issue akin to post-traumatic stress disorder?
Well, the PTSD is not new. The experience is not new, only the finding that abductees have got it, so to speak. The fact is, the stuff has been around forever. Anybody that's been through this phenomenon, many of them have this and or other maladies related to the UFO phenomenon, and PTSD is only one of them. PTSD is often expressed by people who came back from the war, as an example, and they have night terrors, problems, and difficulties, and they have a real difficult time managing this sort of thing. One of the best things that you can do, in my opinion, is to find someone, and if possible, find someone who is an abductee that is skilled, at least, in my opinion, a master level in neuro-linguistic programming and at least a master level in hypnotherapy and has had training by someone like myself who knows how to deal with this kind of phenomena and various difficulties with that. I worked in a hypnotherapy clinic for 4 years, and between 8 to 12 hours a day, 5-6 days a week, I saw every kind of case you could even imagine come through that office. And my point is that there's more than just PTSD involved. And when you work with these people, you need to be able to give them a cushion. You need to be able to extract their information, if that's the purpose, without leaving them in a nightmare of psychological shambles. And if you don't do that, and I give you case after case, even one case where a hypnotherapist worked with someone, and I simply, they were asking me to look at an eye pattern that they had when I was out in, that was in 1992 in Phoenix, and as soon as the light flashed into her eye, she hit the floor out cold completely. And, I mean, in a deep trance, not knocked out, I mean, in a deep trance. And what the guy had not done was clean up his act after he had worked with her, and when the light flashed into her eye, reminded her of the exact same event, she immediately went back into the same state that she was in when the alien got her. And I discussed this with her and with her son, who was there as well, and I said, you need to go talk to your hypnotherapist and talk to him a little bit about what he needs to know and what he obviously doesn't know. So there, to me, you should be, your brain is kind of an important thing. I refer to abductees as a is an archaeological site psychologically. And you don't want somebody who's real good with the backhoe, so to speak, to come over there and dig up your find. I mean, you've got one of the most incredible finds in the world in your subconscious. You don't need somebody who's good with a backhoe, so to speak. Just because they can hypnotize you doesn't mean they know what they're doing. And get in there and dig up your incredible archaeological find with a backhoe and tear it all to pieces and expect somebody like me to come along, or Joe or somebody else, and say, oh, go ahead and fix all this, because it's just broken up into 2 million pieces now. You really need to get somebody who knows what they're doing. And your local hypnotist who can hypnotize you is not the answer. If people ask me, why haven't people hypnotized you? And I said, I never found anybody that I felt qualified to work on my brain. Not because it's better, but because it's the only one I've got. And I don't want anybody tampering with me until I train them or make sure they know exactly what it is that I want done. And, I mean, that's the tough way to talk about it, but that is the way it is as far as I'm concerned. So nobody tampers with my brain unless I train them and they know exactly what I want, what's going on, and it has to happen that way, bottom line.
That makes a great deal of sense to me. A very wise strategy there. Well, everyone, we'll be back in about 8 minutes. We're taking a very quick break, and we'll immediately resume this great discussion with Daryl Sims. And Daryl, your main site again is alienhunter.org?
That's correct, and that's the Alien Hunter site. And the other one is OperationAlienDNA.com, and you can see at either one of those sites, you can see incredible video right on the very front page of actual implants in situ, that's in the person to this day. One of the ladies is they've got the implant in her brain on the front of my book on the implants. That's her arm you're looking at there on video. She's got one in her arm, and we're going to remove that one when I go to Brazil this year.
Excellent. Well, look forward to that second segment of the interview now in about 7 minutes, and we'll be right back, everyone. Thanks, Daryl, and thanks to our listeners, and also our great researchers in the room. Welcome back to A Global Focus with guest Daryl Sims, the Alien Hunter. Daryl Sims has authored with Patricia Gray 2 books. The first, Alien Hunter, The Evidence and Light. And the second, Alien Hunter, Evidence and Truth About Alien Implants. Back to our discussion with Daryl Sims, the Alien Hunter. Also, before we resume the second segment of the interview, I just wanted to note the excellent programs on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, including UFO Undercover with host Joe Montaldo on Wednesday evenings from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, and our Thursday evening program, Second Sight, New York City, with hosts Chris George and Stephanie Vanetti. Excellent show. And our Friday program with host Karen Dolan, Through the Keyhole, on Fridays from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern. Okay, Daryl, I can't wait to resume this discussion. And also, I wanted to note 2 great questions and comments from the room. Again, from our Goddess of Fire, our researcher, she was making the point, I think it's a good one, and I'd like to get your input on this as well, that with contactees, sometimes it's very advisable to let them heal and then get the information later. Is there a time criticality here, or is it sometimes better to wait? What do you think?
In my opinion, if a person can... and doesn't need to know that information, in my opinion, most of them should not ever find it out. They should let it go, and if you can live without it, let it go. The reason is, once you let that genie out of the bottle, you'll never get Pandora's box closed again. It will be that I can get story after story of that. In my case, it didn't make any difference. I was wide awake. I mean, I can't not remember. It's there. It is. Sorry, it's done. But in cases who have an opportunity, they know something happened and they really don't know if they should delve into that and so on. In my opinion, you ought to let it go, because it may be something you don't want to deal with, and you're going to have to deal with it after that. And you're going to have kids, you're going to have relatives, and you're going to take ridicule and all kinds of stuff from people that you never, ever thought this could ever happen, and it will. And the question you have to ask is, do you want to do that? And if you don't want to do it, you can live without it. In my opinion, let it go.
Thanks for that response. Much appreciated. Now, thanks for that great comment there, Goddess of Fire. Now, Daryl, if we could please now turn to the subject of fluorescence. Now, your book has a tremendous amount of information, both of them, on the alien embedded fluorescence aspect. Here, quoting from the book, supporting evidence, fluorescence, often anomalous and not suspected by the abductee. Ultraviolet fluorescence will be multivariate in color. Fluorescence in rare cases may give the appearance of subdermal movement, and the fluorescence may appear in a visual marking form such as mixed spectrum alien light pattern, end quote. Now we've got a great question coming in from our New York researcher, Lily. Excellent mind. Now, this is the question. She's wondering, Lily is wondering, Daryl, if you've ever done a chemical analysis on this fluorescence. And now, you have done tests, but you haven't mentioned chemical tests. Lily would be interested in knowing, Daryl, what chemicals were found in the fluorescence.
We have not done the kind of tests that we really want to do. And we did have an individual that was doing some testing for us some time ago. And the individual, I'm sorry to have to say this, lost the samples, and the samples were destroyed. I don't know what that means, and I don't even want to speculate on. But the point is, now the samples that I gather, that I'm confident with, we're going to make sure that never happens again. We have not done the type of testing that we should. These are great questions. I was confronted and had a dinner with a researcher that everybody here knows, and he told me, he said, you don't understand what you have. And I said, what do you mean? He said, you have been given a gift. And I said, by whom? He said, the alien. And I said, okay, well, why does alien want to give me gifts? And he says, well, this is a gift from the alien, and it, what it is this is, in fact, a chemical, this is a, what was the term he used? It's rather amazing. He and I disagreed a lot about the fluorescence. And he said, it's an energy pattern. And I said, well, it's actually a chemical pattern in my view. He said, no, it's an energy pattern. I said, well, now you, number one, haven't seen it, and number two, have never had any influence with it. You're not an abductee. And you don't have a clue, so we'll just leave it at that and let what the science finds out about it decide that for us. And I said, I don't think the alien's going to run around giving me gifts so that I can expose what they're up to. So that was the first thing. The second thing is that the fluorescence on physical contact, when the alien touches you, whoever the alien or whatever the alien is, he leaves a physical trace on you. And the reason people never thought that there was any evidence is because they couldn't see it. Well, you can't see in the infrared and ultraviolet range, so you have to have UV or IR equipment to do that. One of the ways to help you with that, and I suggested this a long time ago when we first discovered this in 1992, was that people ought to get a black light and it basically shine it on themselves from time to time, especially if you've had or you feel like something may have happened, or even if you don't think that's happened, just get under the black light anyway and see what happens. And some people have done that and found remarkable finds on themselves. Two primary things show up. One is a procedural fluorescence, and the other fluorescence that shows up is from casual contact. That's the thing with where the aliens touch you and left a fingerprint, so to speak, or long fingers show on you in black light. And the procedural ones are much more different. They might, one of them, the first one we found, was literally a Mandelbrot set on the inside of a lady's arm. So we do know that it is obviously this chemical base. We feel like that it is probably something exuded from the skin of the entity itself. I like to call it alien motor oil, but that's obviously not what it is. But just a little humor there in a very serious subject. But I assure you, the next samples that I have will be studied properly and under my direct personal watch. So there will be no mistakes. There will be no, oh, I'm sorry, it's all gone. It disappeared, and so on and so on. We've even had that happen with implants with people, and it's not going to happen again, ever, not on my watch.
Well, I appreciate those sentiments and those great questions here from Kopp, one of our favorite researchers from the Northeast, a great policeman. Now, he's wondering, now, of course, your two books reference the different types of implants. There's several different descriptions, profiles of them for the implants. But here's Kopp's question. It's great. It's just a general one. How big is the implant, and what materials is it made out of? And then he wants all the factors, why, when, who, where. He wants all the details.
Typical Kopp. Very good. Very good. The fact is that these are great questions, and a good cop would ask those. These are, and they're good, tough questions, and they should be. The fact is there's two levels of implants, and we'll just deal with the first one, the ones cop want to deal with first, and that is the visible implants. There's also invisible implants, and that one's obviously much different subject. But the visible implants themselves, in a nutshell, which my book covers, the fact is that these objects are different kinds of objects. There are the classifications alone. Some are cocooned, and they are wrapped inside usually the individual's skin. In other words, those scoop marks you find on an abductee, guess where the skin went? It went to the lab of an alien, so to speak, and they may be using it on an implant. In the individual, implants are extremely rare. They're not common. Anybody that says they are simply doesn't know what they're talking about. They're extremely rare. I look at hundreds of x-rays every year, and I assure you that we do not find implants in every abductee. That is just not true. So that's the good news. The interesting news is the objects that we do find are either cocooned or non-cocooned, generally speaking. And some of them, in some cases, are incubated. And I'll explain that very briefly. And then I'll get into some of the features that they contain. The cocooned objects are like the ones we removed publicly in the first public surgeries, 1995. We actually had other implants before that, but the ones that were publicly done in a medical setting was, in fact, cocooned or wrapped. The objects, which were metallic, which had, and for the top here, please email me at one of my websites there, alienhunter.org or operationaliendna.com. Email me off of there, and I'll be glad to send you some of the reports, and you're welcome to them. Not a problem. No cost to anything that we do here. Number one is that's the cocoon ones. Those are, we found literally the skin of the abductee wrapped around these metallic objects, which look like short quarter-inch needle-like projections, which turned out to be rare meteorites from the Widmannstätten or the Yauch-Shung meteorite. This is absolutely phenomenal because meteorites don't end up in people, and rare ones don't at all. And so for that to be there with no signs of scarring, no signs of entry or anything, doesn't make any sense until you study the case. Number two, there's the non-cocooned. These are implants like such as we, nasal implants is an example, which you'll find sometimes in individuals. We're looking at several cases of that right now. We found 8 little gold spheres in a little girl's nose. They were literally, when she sneezed, they came out. They were the size of a dull pinhead. They're extremely small. I have 2 of those that, I'll show you the pictures of them if you're interested. And second is another one that was real interesting to us was out of the mass abduction of December 8, 1992, an ocular implant fell out of a lady's eye while she was at work. And her boss, who knew something about my work, made her bring it to me because the lady was trying to sweep it off into the carpet. She said it was just a seed or a grain of sand that was bothering her all night long. And she said, if you don't take that object to that investigator, I'm going to fire you on the spot. Well, she brought it to me, and then we found out through testing at the University of Houston that it, in fact, was not a seed. It was not a anything like what they imagined. It was actually a ceramic-based material that housed, in our opinion, a biological camera. The third area, which is kind of weird, is incubated implants. Now, these have to do with all missing fetus syndrome and the missing twin syndrome and so-called alleged alien term pregnancy. Now, one can argue that stuff all you want to, but the fact is I don't have to argue it, and I don't have to sit here and say, well, I believe these people because under hypnosis they told me. A lot of these people are telling me this stuff without any hypnosis whatsoever and in great detail. But better than all that is we have some sonograms of a quote-unquote alien in situ, in the womb. That kind of eliminates the argument of, well, I don't really believe it. Well, it doesn't make a difference what you believe. Medical evidence is there. So those are just three areas of implants, the cocooned, non-cocooned, and incubated, that we can say. And as I said, some of these things, the rare meteorite ones that were found in these two different people who are not even related in Texas, these turned out to be rather amazing because each of these objects had 11 different elements surrounding them that had nothing to do with the rare Wittmann-Statton structure meteorite. Then in the fact that they were also wrapped with the abductee's skin so that the abductee would not not only not know it, but the body would never recognize it because it was their own entire biology that was there covering the implant so that the body would never recognize it. They would never know it.
Very fascinating information there. Now, Daryl, quick question. At times, the reception is breaking up. So when it sounds good, really good again, I'm going to just ask you to just stand there. Now, quick question. I've noted, among the other very intriguing aspects as to the implants, the fact that you believe that some of these implants are attempting to affect endorphin levels. You note in your first book research that points to attempted alteration of neurotransmitters and electrolytes. Could you give some details on this? Did I properly describe that?
I could. You have discovered it well. The fact is that abductees we found back in, again, the late 80s, early 90s, were reporting from their doctor because of other things. It was interesting that after their events, their abduction encounters were over, they had altered levels of neurotransmitters, serotonin, dopamine, potassium, etc. This caused us to write a report about that. And again, the report's available. Anybody wants to email me at alienhunter.org or Operation Alien DNA, you can go there and click on Daryl and it'll email me immediately. And I'll be glad to send you the report and the information we have on that. But the fact is some of these people have had their neurotransmitters altered. And a pharmacist wrote me, who worked on our staff for a while, years and years ago, and she said, basically, Daryl, this is absolutely incredible stuff you've discovered here. She said, do you realize that if anybody controls your dopamine or serotonin, they literally own you. They can control you in every sense of the way. They run your show, so to speak. And I said, of course. And anyway, she was obviously a PhD, and this was pretty amazing to her. She was rather stunned and wanted us to give her all kinds of information. I said, that's the reason you're here. You're going to help us find out more, and we need to use your skills to do that. So this report that I'll send whoever wants to read it, you're welcome to email, and I'll be glad to send it to you. You may be rather surprised to find out that you're on that list.
Well, that's interesting information, but really key question here, Daryl. Has there also been research performed as to negating any effects of such a type of alteration? Hopefully we'll just be in the beginning stations of not even manifesting yet.
Well, the fact is that if you notice a change in your behavior, how you feel, how you react with others. If you notice that sort of occurring, you would want to talk to your doctor and ask him to check your neurotransmitters, these levels, and ask him to test you for that. And if you found that sort of thing going on, obviously a doctor can, under his care, can bring those back to correct levels himself. That would be, in my view, one of the best ways to do that. Or he would put you on a program of vitamins or something to increase that status of your neurotransmitter, so that you would not be. You might not want to mention the word alien when you talk to him about that. You might want to say, I've noticed my behaviors have changed, and sometimes I feel this or I don't, and I wondered if that might have anything to do with altered levels of neurotransmitters. Maybe something I'm doing or not taking or not whatever might be affecting that. I wouldn't ever mention the word alien. You'll find him or her much more agreeable and treating and working with you in that regard. But the point is that if he does the test, that's going to tell you whether that's true or not for you. And the way to fix it, obviously, is he's going to show you how to take care of that. That's the best thing.
Thank you. That's very detailed information there. Much appreciated. Now, I have a great question here from Ka, but a real question here, too, that would, my mind, would be, for example, with these different types of implants, including the implants that are encased in a cellular network, how can they be discovered? Could you give the different processes whereby a team, a medical team, or your team could ascertain the presence of such an implant?
Great question again. Typical cop. Good questions. Going after the evidence. Go to the facts. Go to the hard stuff, not the theoretical. This is very good. The fact is that the way I discovered implants initially, begin with, is I happen to be awake on a craft, lying on a table. I call it the slab. It's very different, very hard. My feet elevated 11 degrees, and I was present while they were doing the procedure. I actually saw the 11, that's not true. It was, God was very small, so they probably looked larger to me. Probably a needle-like device about 7 to 8 inches long, and had a little silver sphere on the end of it, and after they inserted my nasal passage and jammed it way past it, I felt pain way back behind my eye. There was no anesthesia. I felt the whole thing and was wide awake during the entire event. But the best way to find this sort of thing, number one, is to read the literature and realize people claim that they were implanted up the nasal passage, or they did something in my nose, in my arm, they did something over here or something. That's a place where you need to have them go and get an X-ray, if they can. And usually the cheapest way to do it, because you have to understand, some of the people I've worked with are either very cheap or very poor. So I tell them, well, if you can't afford a doctor, you can't do that, go to your local chiropractor that has an X-ray machine. You'll charge $30-$40, whatever. It's a lot cheaper. And just tell him you bumped yourself on the face there near the nose, and you just want to have it X-rayed. And this friend of yours who has got a doctor buddy said, well, have him get a soft tissue X-ray. And that they know exactly what to do when you say that. And anything's in that area, wherever it's at, in the arm or the elbow or the knee or the neck or the face or wherever, the nasal passage, when they X-ray that area, if there's something there that's radio opaque, it will show up. 99.999999% of the time, it will show up on an X-ray. We have one case in Brazil where the implant, and that's the one that's on my website. If you go to that, click on the film that's right there on the very front page, you'll see a lady playing with this object inside her arm. It's the size of a large pill. That object cannot be seen on an X-ray. It freaked her doctor completely out. Not only that, he says, well, I'll fix that. And so they did an MRI on it. Now, thousands of little shots of that thing. It didn't show up on the MRI either. That's the first time we've ever had that happen, ever. But this was predicted, by the way, in 1994 when I did a presentation to 250 surgeons and doctors at John Muir Medical Hospital. I was the first and the only abductee and a UFO investigator ever to present to medical doctors in an AMA-sponsored program for continuing education on medical complications of alleged human-alien contact, and the subject matter was implants.
Boy, thank you very much. That those details are very, very intriguing. Very intriguing, very informative. And I remember that conference as well. You've referenced it before, and also hearing other people speak of it. Now, another great question from Cott. He's wondering if individuals with implants can live normal lives, or will implants interfere with them? Will they knowingly realize they have one?
Great question. The fact is that many of these people do not even know they have an implant. Most of them will have effects on their life that will affect them, and many people who have some of these symptoms that I've got listed, these are abductee symptoms and not necessarily symptomology of an implant. We don't know the full answer to what they exactly do. We think we know. But we can't say definitively, thus saith, and it's the case. We don't know that yet. We have some pretty good ideas, but we can't prove all this stuff. This, again, has to be studied another way. But generally speaking, many people, because they have the symptomology that we list on our website, and Joe has listed as well, and others have, it doesn't mean they have an implant. It means they're probably abductees or contactees, and they have been exploited by various types of procedures and so on, and some of the effects of it are horrific. Some of these people will end up with rare drug allergies to procaines, lidocaines, the novocaine, cocaine, any of the cane family, the carbocaine. It won't make any difference. On the other hand, other people will not only have rare drug allergies that will range from hives to coma with these, with the procaine, but people like myself just do the reverse. It doesn't seem to have much or any effect on us whatsoever. When I first got Novocaine, the first time I went to a dentist, about 18, I guess, I'm telling you, I thought I was going to have to beat that doctor up. He started drilling the Novocaine, didn't do a thing for me, nothing. It deadened the skin, but it did not affect the nerves in my teeth. And I still have that problem to this day, and I finally, after learning hypnosis, becoming a master hypnotherapist, finally tranced myself out and had them put me on nitrous oxide, and I just trance out because I can still feel it. And I'm telling you, it's just horrific. It's horrific. But the fact is, these people will not know it most of the time. The way you find implants generally is you listen to a person's speech patterns, and they'll say, "Oh, well, I was on this table, and well, what were they doing to you or with you? Did they have a place of interest? Oh, well, they were real interested in my foot. I don't know why." Guess what place you need to be x-rayed? The foot. If it was the ear, if it was the nose, the nasal passage, that's the place that you might want to get an x-ray. And if you get an x-ray, you're not going to know what you're going to be looking for. And I don't mean to belittle anyone here, but your doctor often isn't going to know what he's looking for either. He's not going to understand what it is he's looking at in most cases. Send the x-rays to me or copies of them, and we will look at them. I have doctors on staff, and I don't mind telling you, one of our surgeries out in Santa Monica, the cardiovascular surgeon was present, and the brain surgeon. We were looking at the implant, which I call the AOL or implant. Looked like an AOL symbol with a dot in the middle of it. And they looked at it and said, "What do you think?" And I said, "It's not an implant." He said, "But it's radio opaque, it's solid." I said, "But he's a mechanic. He gets around and crawls on his knees, hands and knees. That's not an alien implant, although he is an abductee. I absolutely 100% believe that, and I know that for myself." I said, "But it's not an implant." He said, "What do you want to do?" I said, "We want to remove it anyway because we want to show people we're not afraid of looking at anything. We don't have to have something to prove we're right. We're looking at evidence, period. You have to not be afraid of any kind of evidence that you're going to uncover, period."
Thanks for that response. Now we're getting a great question here from a frequent room visitor. I don't know if I should even use his nick, but he always makes great comments. And his question to you, Daryl, is how hard is it to place a hypnotic suggestion to become conscious during an experience? And now that is something that your team seems to approve of for those who would be willing to gather information on the alien.
Oh, boy, I'll tell you, I like this guy already. This is, now you're alien hunting. Now you're going after them. You're not waiting to be a victim. You want to go after them. I'll give you some good advice about that. One, it can be done. Number two, I'm not to do this, and I'll tell you why. Because, number one, the alien is going to find out, in most cases, what you did. And they're going to make it tough on the person you did that to. There are all kinds of funny little things they like to do to them for betraying them. And number two, you're going to bring attention to yourself. Now, if you're prepared for that, that's okay, but you also have to be respectful of the fact that whoever you're doing this to, the only time I've ever done this with individuals is when there was an absolute need to do it, and you've got to realize I'm an abductee. I haven't just been a victim of this stuff. I've been inside that freaking alien's head. I know how he thinks. I know what he does. And I've done this for well over 40 years. I hate to say how much more than that, but more than I care to admit. And my point is that when you mess with these guys, be prepared if you uncover or do something that irritates them, that somebody else is going to show up. And it won't be an alien. I'll give you a hint. If we refer to by what some people refer to in the UFO community as a MIB, he's going to show up and he's going to ring your bell. The MIB, one of his primary purposes is to fix problems that the alien cannot deal with or cannot fix. And he's there to fix it. And if you ever see two of them in the same event, which is extremely rare, the problem is more serious than you even know.
Thanks. Very interesting. Now, this MIB reference is bring to my mind that concept of transgenic. Now, am I correct, Daryl, you consider the alien to be a transgenic? You also consider the MIB or Man in Black or Men in Black to be transgenics. You also reference the aliens as amoral, just fulfilling a program that their creators have implanted or implemented in them, enabled them to do. Now, way back in this program, we had a great question from Goddess of Fire regarding what this might relate to as far as cosmology, any type of a demonic factor or Nephilim factor. Could you just kind of give some explanations or information there? It's very interesting. I like the idea of the concept of alien as transgenic. Go from there. Sorry.
Very good. First of all, let's back up and just look at the alien to begin with, just real basically. Most people know what the gray is. Most people know what the doctor type is. It looks like a gray, but taller. He's a lot smarter. The gray has got an IQ of about 80, 85 maybe if he's smart. And the doctor type's got an IQ of about 160. He's real sharp. The Mantis being has got an IQ of around 180, about 200, real smart. The humanoid, or what some people refer to as the Nordic, which is a misnomer. The American Indians call them the Sisitas. There are brunettes, there are blonde-haired, it doesn't matter. And then you've got this thing called, it looks like a Wookiee, it's a Bigfoot, that thing. Those are the primary things, and a reptile-type creature. You see those in the UFO phenomena more than anything. So you got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, about 7 different types. You got different ones that people report. These are the primary ones that are there. In my opinion, you're looking at transgenic beings who are not from another planet. They're from Earth. You say, what in the world are you talking about? What do you think the chances are of you finding a quote-unquote insect or bug just like you found on planet Earth on some other planet in some other distant star? The exact same thing, except it happens to be 6 foot tall, and it's coming here to abduct you. Almost, there's no actual aerial for that. You're not going to find it. Number two, what do you think the chances of you finding something that the Navajos and the Hopi referred to as the ant people in ancient times. Those are the Greys and the doctor types. Because originally, their DNA probably was from an insect, specifically an ant. And they looked like ants back then, but now they've been modified to look more, quote-unquote, if you will. And then you've got these humanoid types, the so-called Nordics. These are nothing more than transgenics as well, and I could spend a whole night just on that subject alone. And they are, in fact, nothing more than a human form to interact with you on the behalf, again, of others. And then you've got this Bigfoot thing, this egg-like creature, this... where did they get the DNA for all these creatures? I'll give you a hint. They got it from Earth. They modified it on a craft out there, a craft that's approximately, are you ready for this, 2,000 miles long. And yes, that the craft has been seen on NASA footage, and it's actually available to look at. And the fact is that, in my opinion, that craft is a craft where I call the alien Dr. Moreau does his grisly work of creating these transgenics, and many of them. And some of them are even much different than these, but most of them look like this stuff that abductees are going to mostly respond to. And so basically, that's where the DNA comes from. It comes from Earth, not from them, not from outer space. In fact, what does an alien need a 2,000-mile spacecraft for if he's got a planet, or many planets, or millions of planets, or he can go to any planet he wants to? Why does he need a craft so massive that makes something like the movie Star Wars, the so-called Death Star, makes it look like a joke? This thing is massive. The fact is, that's where he resides. He doesn't have a planet because he, number one, didn't come from one, and two, he just needs a place to work and to take care of his work and to store his quote-unquote craft.
Also, Daryl, was I correct from reading your material that the aliens themselves can have implants?
In my opinion, that's my one of my questions. I think it's chapter 7 of my book. It's a question Pat was asking one day. She says, "Do you have anything you'd really like to throw out there?" It's a real eye-opener. I said, "Sure." I said, "Do aliens have implants?" And she laughed and said, "I have never heard that anything like that in my life." And she said, "What's the answer?" And I said, "The alien is an implant. He is a transgenic. He is a modified entity with the DNA come from Earth in most cases and is modified for the purpose of interaction with human beings here." I said, "The ruse of the story is that they're aliens from other planets." Well, that sounds fine and that sounds good. But in every culture, all over the world, everybody's got a different name and a different story for who they are. Notice that the alien has never corrected any of those stories. They've never said, "Oh, we're a transgenic off of this massive craft up here." They never told the truth to anybody. They simply let you buy into whatever your whopper is. If you want to think they're gods, they'll let you think that. If you want to think they're aliens, they don't care. If you want to think they're the jinn of Islam, that's fine. They don't care. If you want to think they're the wee fairy folk of the Irish, that's okay. Nobody cares. They don't want you to know who they are or who sent them.
And dovetailing into that comment, I note here that Gossifier is asking, so the beings on the craft would be the demonic Anunnaki, Anunnaki, pardon me, demonic Anunnaki or what? Also, my question that I think segues also is that, Daryl, what's the significance of the ancient gods, including the Egyptian cosmology, to you as far as they relate to the alien phenomenon? And is Zaira, GOF as we call her, comment correct there? Are they Anunnaki? I mean, I'm sorry, not her comment, but she's just proposing one theory that she's heard.
Great, great historical questions here. In my opinion, many folks are missing some key pieces to the story, but they have they're going in the right direction, but they're just missing big chunks of information. In other words, just knowing that the Anunnaki existed, knowing that the transgenics exist, and knowing that that this stuff exists doesn't mean that everything that's in your head now is the story. I mean, you don't know everything. I don't know everything. So therefore, since we don't know everything, we need to leave some open ends here to fill in the blanks. In other words, if you don't, you'll end up creating entire stories about what you think it is because it can't be anything else because I don't know anything else. So therefore, it has to be what I think it is. And if that's not the course of investigation, you have to leave things open. It, an inquiry, rather than just an investigation, an inquiry is open-ended. It never ends. And that's if you ever get a congressional inquiry on you, you're in trouble because they can come after you forever over all kinds of stuff, anything. And whereas just an investigation on a specific charge or a crime or something like that, you can deal with that. But an inquiry is open-ended. It never ends. So leave your UFO work and your investigations open-ended. Make it an inquiry, and you'll always be, in the sense of the word, you can always say, I don't know, but here's what I've found so far. So having said that, I've talked to scholars and others, biblical people who are skilled in Sumerian, Ugaritic, Hebrew, ancient languages, dead languages, et cetera, all kinds of people. And the long short of that story is that we all want to wrap this up into a nice bow. We want to know what is the big one they haven't told us. And I'll help you out a little bit here. First of all, if I were, I don't care who they are, the first thing I would take the word demonic and just throw it out of the picture. A demon, by definition, is a disembodied spirit. Disembodied spirit isn't an alien. A disembodied spirit is a spirit that had a body that doesn't have one now and is looking to possess someone. I've only seen three cases of demon possession in my entire life, and two of them were in Korea when I was in the military there. I assure you it was nothing like psychological illness or mental, it wasn't anything like that. I studied psychology when I was in college, and trust me, what I saw there was something out of the New Testament. It had nothing to do with being mentally ill whatsoever. They knew, and whatever was within them knew exactly what was going on, and it knew who I was, and it knew who other people were around there, supernaturally. It's not the same thing. The alien is not a demon. Forget that whole term. In my opinion, are they so-called alien, are they on the bad side? Yes, absolutely. But that doesn't make them demonic. It makes what they do bad. A demon is something different. Aliens don't inhabit people and people walk around and they're possessed of aliens. That doesn't even make sense. So the demon thing is it's a misnomer to use here. The fact is that in my second book, I've described the hierarchy of the alien to some small degree. I'm writing a third book where I'll go into great detail and show you basically a pyramid and on the back of a dollar bill, and I'm not a conspiracist, so I don't care about all that. But the back of the dollar bill, that pyramid you see on the back, that's not really a pyramid, it's a ziggurat. It's not a pyramid, it never was a pyramid, it never was supposed to be a pyramid. It is in fact the original illustration in a visible way of the verse Nimrod, the Tower of Nimrod. And it's an ancient image, and it actually, in my opinion, describes the alien presence, and not the alien per se. The alien's only on the bottom. There's 13 layers of that thing. He's on the bottom layer, and only on one side, and only in one section. This thing is so big you can't even begin to imagine it. And if you try to make the alien fit the demon and fit this and fit that and all this other stuff, you're going to run around making yourself go crazy trying to fit this stuff together because it doesn't work like that. It's a totally different view, and I'm not trying to sell books here. I'm just telling you need to read the book or talk to me in detail, and I'll be glad to go over that with you. But basically, there are four sides of that so-called pyramid. It's not a pyramid. It's a ziggurat. The ziggurat has got the top cut off of it. You'll see them all over the world. They're not pyramids. It isn't the Great Pyramid of Egypt. It isn't any of that. These are ziggurats. The ones in Tulum, the ones in all these different places around the world, I don't care where they're at, in China and everywhere else, they are the same. You'll find them in Turkey. It doesn't make any difference. These are ziggurats. They are not pyramids. They are the illustration of, in fact, what is going on, in my view. And four sides to them, 13 layers going up. In my opinion, what most of us are looking at is one or two, three little blocks down there, maybe six or seven little blocks on the base of that first, on the front of the pyramid, of that so-called ziggurat. That's all we're looking at, and we don't even have a real clear view of what that is. We're still thinking it's an alien from another planet. We don't have a clue. And you don't know what's on the other side, the left side. You don't know what's on the right side, and you don't know what's on the back side. And you don't know what the other layers are that go up. This thing is so big that you can't even begin to imagine. I mean, I kid you not. This is amazing, and it is the only way, in my view, you can even begin to comprehend this whole thing is you have to have a spiritual hat also to look at this stuff. If you have only the spiritual hat and you don't look at it with anything else, you're going to come up short in a lot of directions, in my view, because you just can't ignore this stuff. You can't. You do it at your own peril, and you'll end up coming up with all this thrown into a giant pile, and it has to be this one rock, this one square on the base of that pyramid, so to speak, that ziggurat, and you'll say, well, that's what it's all about. Well, you're not even close. The Anunnaki are just is a term for those who came down. Now, Sitchin terribly mistakenly wrote those who came down from heaven. That's not what it says in the Hebrew language. That's not even close. It's those who were kicked out of heaven. They were kicked out with an iron boot, so to speak. They were thrown out. That's who the Anunnaki are. They are the fallen ones. They came down from heaven, and literally, this stuff is all over other historical documents. It's not just in Sumerian. It's not just in Hebrew. It's not just the Bible. It's not even just the New Testament. It's in Vedic literature. It's in Wakan literature. It's all over the world. You just have to take the whispers off of it or the mythology of that current populace in that area, and you'll find that a lot of stuff just dovetails together. It is consistent worldwide. But they came here, and even Sitchin admits this, they came here and enslaved humanity. They didn't come here to save the ozone hole, to make you smarter, bigger. And in fact, their DNA program back then is correct, as some of these people allege, and I'm not in agreement with it, but it doesn't matter if they're correct. They modified people for the purpose of what? Work. Physically working and being slaves to their purpose.
Now, Daryl, do I have time? And thank you. Those details definitely are very thought-provoking. One more question. It's from a frequent visitor of our room, a favorite, Skymon. And his question for you, Daryl, are there any updates on the John Edmonds case? And am I confused? There was a case in the Midwest, very important, but also that I can think of a very fine attorney with that name. Okay, I know I'm confused here. What's this?
Okay, there's no new information yet. We have had several people who are interested in trying to defend themselves in these events, and in my view, they should. I think that people ought to defend themselves. I think that is a right, and I think that people ought to protect themselves in any way they can. The fact is, if you're going to do this sort of thing, I'm telling you, it's not as simple as one might think. You don't do this stuff without repercussion. I'm not telling people to lay down and take it. I'm telling you that there's more to this and that you be careful what you wish for. You may actually get it and you may not like it when it shows up. And you might be successful and you might not.
Well, thanks for that response. And Daryl, thanks so much for being a guest this evening. I hope you'll be a soon return guest. Sounds to me as though you'll have a very interesting weekend there in L.A. Any final comments?
Final comments is keep your eye on the ridge and your nose in the wind and your powder dry. For those of you who want to defend yourself with alien phenomena out there against this phenomena, I suggest that you use all your hacks and not just one of them. All your hats. And if you can defend yourself, I'd love to hear about your stories. If you wanted to bend yourself, email me. I'll be glad to send you a lot of information that we have that might be useful or helpful to you.
Well, thanks, Daryl. And again, hope you'll be back very soon here to be a guest. And thanks to our listeners and to our great researchers and visitors to the network room as well. Everyone have a great weekend. Have a great trip there, Daryl. Wonderful speaking with you. Good night.
Thanks, Kathy.
Daryl Sims, the Alien Hunter. Your time with us is appreciated, and we wish everyone a great weekend. Hello, everyone. Therese Sheridan, host of A Global Focus. Come join us each Friday evening.